good one.
The participle.
Yeah.
We'll get to hear feel things as we go too.
But you know that's part of our learning process is to get in the savvy is to know what to expect as being suspicious. I smell something here. You know, I better not
jump too quick on this one. And so that's, you know, that's what I expect you to retain from, you know, these intensive discussions here. Speaking of intensive, we're in the PL.
Well, it's not really so much to read and translate as it is to read and recognize and see the grammatical relationships and be able to look it up and find out exactly
sure.
what's going on here.
See, if we expected you to be able to translate everything just as you read it, we would do a lot more vocabulary. I mean, there'd be thousands of vocabulary words instead of just a few hundred, you know.
How many vocabulary words are there in there?
I don't know. I never saw a figure on that. Did anybody know?
I think there's about 9,000 strong.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's probably pretty close then.
That's
Greek is about 5,000. Yeah, as far as individual forms, that's another story. See, potentially every verb's got about 144 potential forms. Not all of them have that many, but...
That's bad. It's three. Mm-hmm. I think there's 120 parts possible potentially for each.
Uh-huh. If you start considering all the declension, oh, yeah, really?
That's
never think about it that way. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Both of these languages are quite different than English in that respect. So, you know, German you can relate to a little bit more with the case endings and so forth. And but even their verb systems are pretty simple. But when you get to, these languages are a lot more workload as far as memorization. Well, lesson 40. We began talking about PL verbs last time. And... we were beginning to look at these four categories. There's a general kind of, in most textbooks you'll see PL associated with what they call intensive. He kind of shies away from that term a little bit because he tries to break it down a little bit more. And you know, he's not really wrong, he's just trying to get more refinement to it. And most books just kind of generalize it as intensive, but it's intensive in various ideas. This facultativizing or transitivizing something, it can be considered making the verb more intense in a certain way, making it more specific, more powerful, having an action to it, you know, that kind of thing. And that's the idea of intensive just means a very broad idea of they're adding something to this verb. And so the first sense here, facultative or transitivizing, is taking something that was a stative verb and turning it into a transitive verb that has a direct object, that can take a direct object. So if they appear in the call as intransitive or stative, intransitive could just be they don't take a direct object, and stative is meaning describing a state of being, and of course they won't take direct objects. A stative verb is a subclass of the intransitive verb. Such PL verbs usually have a factative meaning, in other words, to make a fact out of something. So call to be sound, PL to make sound, call to be great, PL to magnify. Such a transformation of meaning may also be designated as causative, but we shall restrict this latter term to roots whose call verbs are transitive. In other words, you can see a kind of causative idea here, but they'd rather not use the term causative to describe intransitive verbs becoming transitive. That's really what's happening. Later on, especially with Hifil, we will see transitive verbs also becoming, intensified in a certain way and causative. So it might be better to describe that. And that does happen with the PL in some instances too. For example, a call to learn, the PL to teach or to cause to learn. You see, but see, call to learn, you can learn something. Learn is a transitive verb. It can take a direct object. So we wouldn't really want to say that this was just transitivizing alone. This was definitely causative. And so this would be, to teach is to cause somebody to learn. And the same kind of thing will be seen in Hifil a lot more. That doesn't happen so much in PL, but in Hifil it happens a lot.
Is that really so? I mean, teach is not necessarily to cause somebody to learn. I mean,
well, yeah.
What do you think?
That's a good point.
What's the relationship here? I mean, because I'm relating to English, but what is the relationship in the Hebrew?
Well, is it more cognitive, or is it like thinking, learning to teach?
You've got a good point there, because if there aren't better examples than this, then there may be some question about this. In his field, we will see a very pure causative idea. But here... he says causative, but I've always been a little skeptical of that, because Hiffield will do that. There is a relationship here, but it may not be as simple, like you say, as just saying cause to learn. Just because if you teach somebody, you may not, in fact, be causing them to learn if they're not listening. In other words, you may be up there preaching and teaching, you know, but they may not be receiving. So you're not really causing anybody to learn, even though you'd like to be. So there may be a factor involved there. Yeah, it's the potential, and it's really described from the standpoint of the person who's doing the teaching. Certainly, the intent of somebody who teaches is to cause somebody to learn, and so I think it's really done on the basis of what. In fact, if you use a direct object, he taught so and so, such and such, then usually there's an implied learning on the part of the one who was taught too. In other words, if you've been taught, then the indication is that you did learn it. But there might be a little bit of question in that one. Okay, now here's some examples on the top of page 194. We have avad, to perish, PL form ibad, to destroy. So here the perish is as a passive idea, you might say, or almost a stative idea, and not a transitive verb. And then making it a transitive verb, you've got the idea of causing to perish. You see, you're destroying. Kal, to be light or trivial. In fact, that's the word from which the word kal comes from, simple. But kilel means to curse or to make light of, treat as unimportant. So you're taking and transitivizing that idea. A stative idea of being light or trivial is not being made into a transitive idea of making light or trivial. This would be factitivizing, I suppose he would say it. Kadesh, meaning to be holy. Kiddash, to sanctify. You can see a relationship there. So we've got to cause to be holy, to make holy. Shalem, to be sound. You've got shilam, to make sound or make whole, to recompense or reward. So you're going to see some relationships here. I think as we proceed here with these derived verbs, you'll see that they'll make a lot of verbs using these derived forms. And in English, of course, we may have a completely different verb for it. Chaya, to live or be alive, and chaya, to cause to live or let live. Notice the dogation, the yod there. It's a PL form in the Eric in the first syllable. And this is to cause to live or to let live. Tamei, to be unclean, and timmei, to pollute, to make unclean, you see. Kala, to be at an end, and killa, to finish, complete, bring to an end. So one is stative, to be at an end, the other is a transitive idea, and to make that state come about, to finish, or to complete, bring to an end. Lama, to learn, and limad, to teach. So we've looked at that one already. Yes, Peter?
Like, could you tell me, like, a stated word like
kaveh,
to be heavy? How would that come in the
field?
How would that
translate? You could make it to make heavy, yeah. Or, you know, I don't know. We'd have to check and see if that one had. Not all verbs have a PL, but if it did, it'd probably be to make heavy, and then that could maybe be translated as to intensify or to burden somebody down, or, you know, and it kind of depends on how they chose to use the verb in the language. Sometimes that's what you'll see. And it kind of depends on how they're picturing making heavy, in what sense, and so forth, yeah. So you'll see that lots of times. And I think it's always a good idea when you see a PL verb that has a call to try to compare them. In other words, if you're doing exegesis on something and you happen to run across, as a part of your exegesis, a PL verb, I always like to, if I've got the time and it's possible to do, is to look up and see if there's a call form of it, see what the call meant, and then see what the PL does to it. And it sometimes helps in exegesis just to see, here's the verb that was chosen here, and you can see this intense idea that's in seen here, or whatever analysis might be appropriate there. Same with Hiphil and Hiphil and others that we're going to come to later on. Nifal, to some extent, Nifal is more just passive idea, you know, so that's not quite as, dramatic as some of these would be. Yes?
there just to be this slight difference in meaning between the word reward and phrase to cause to be found.
Yes.
I mean, if you don't see where it's coming from,
right, you might miss it.
Concept,
sure.
And what they're saying.
Yeah. You might miss it. That's the thing. In a lexicon, if it's a PL verb, sometimes they may just list this as reward and not even give you an indication, because that's the way it's used most often. And so it's instructive to look up the call and kind of see how that verb is related to the call idea, and it may give a nuance to that idea of reward that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So I think it's always worth your time to look into it. It might. It might. Yeah. It's worth considering. Mm-hmm. Now, in some instances, you see, for example, there might be another verb for reward, too, that's got a slightly different connotation. And they're translating them in English both as reward, and yet there's a different connotation to them, and you want to preserve that difference if it's an exegetical exposition on the passage or something. Now, in some instances, the call verb is either transitive or intransitive, while the PL verb is specifically transitive. In other words, there are certain stative verbs that can be kind of both a stative idea and an active idea. For example, male, to be full or to fill. It can mean both things. So the idea to be full is intransitive. That's a stative idea. To fill is an active idea. So that verb can mean both, but the PL form, male, means only to fill. It's always got an active meaning, not the intransitive meaning. So it may be PL sometimes could resolve ambiguity in a potential passage where it was really important or something. They just put it in the PL. The PL's got to be transitive. In other words, I would imagine, for example, if you ran into a situation in which you were going to use this verb to be full and you wanted it to mean to fill, but you didn't have a direct object in it. He filled. And then, you know, he was in the act of filling. And you didn't want, you wanted to purposely leave the direct object indefinite. But in doing so, you might generate the confusion if you use the call form. And when you don't see a direct object, your natural tendency is to translate it stative. But suppose you wanted it to be transitive, but you just didn't want to express the direct object, then a PL form would be very appropriate there. Then you could use the PL form, and then the reader would know that this thing is intensive and it's transitive, but there's no direct object stated. Ba'ar, for example, to burn, can either be transitive or intransitive. You can mean the thing burned, the house burned, or you could say he burned the house, and that would be the transitive idea. In other words, the verb burn, even in English, can be both transitive and intransitive, and this verb in Hebrew can be as well, except bi'er, now using it putting in the PL, that means to burn something down, you know, to burn something. That's got a transitive idea. It doesn't mean, you would never use bi'er if you talked about the house burned, or I was burning with rage, or something like that, as a passive idea. It would be, I burned the house down, something like that. That would always, it would be always the sense that you perform the action of burning something, setting fire to something. Okay, yes, Tony?
So in other words then, the difference might be looked at as the difference between an action complete and an action not quite completed yet.
Well, I don't think really that is, see, that distinction would be more of one between the perfect and the imperfect, for example. Perfect being completed action, imperfect being the action, you know, proceeding or yet in the future. That's more of a tense idea to the Hebrew mind. The distinction is whether the action can take a direct object or not. In other words, mainly whether it's really action or whether it's, I guess not so much that, because burning is action, whether something's burning itself or whether it's more of a voice type of an idea. It's more associated with the concept of voice, active, passive, middle. See, to burn here, in the intransitive sense, it's got more of a middle voice idea. The object burned. In other words, it was both performing an action and receiving the action, as it were. Whereas to burn something is to perform an action on something else. So I would say the distinction is more one of voice idea rather than of tense idea or aspect idea. It's not so much whether it's progressive or not or finished or not. It's a matter of who's performing the action, who's receiving the action. Okay, the second category under PL is called denominative. Now, denominative, you see this word nominative here. Denominative, it's got the idea of a noun, the name of something. And the idea of a PL is that the PL can sometimes be used to take a noun and make it into a verb. And so it says, when the PL verb is closer in meaning to some noun or adjective than to the call verb, which in most of these cases does not exist. In other words, usually when you have a denominative PL, there's no call that even exists. Sometimes there is, but most of the time there's not. And what's happened here is you've taken a noun, perhaps, and turned it into a verbal idea and used a PL to indicate that. We may say that the PL has a denominative function. So and there's quite a few examples of this. So this is very definitely an aspect of what the PL is doing. And you can almost think of this, too, in an intensive sense. You're kind of intensifying the idea of a noun into an action. If you think of it that way, you could still call this, like other grammars do, as intensive. In other words, many of the grammar books just refer to PL as intensive, and then under intensive they put all these categories, you know. And so he makes intensive one of his categories. He just kind of divided things up. He seems to have a tendency not to want to go the traditional way, which sometimes can be good and sometimes can be bad. So he's definitely got his good points, and he's got his little quirks and idiosyncrasies that come out, too. But anyway, this denominative function is real clear. For example, here we have the word davar, meaning word, and then dibber, to speak, you see, is the PL form of that. Of course, we see it's a goal here, so it's a little bit irregular in that respect. But this is to speak. In other words, you've got your speaking is active. It's taking the action of words, and it's built from the idea of a word. I suppose you might say to make words or something, you know, to speak. And then sefer, book or record, becomes siper, to recount, narrate, or tell a story. In other words, to bookize, as it were, you know, to make something as a book, to recount, to narrate, to tell a story, just like books do. So you're verbalizing the concept of a book. Beracha. Is means blessing, and Beirach in PL form means to bless. Then mitzvah, command, and you get tzvah, to command. So you've got a noun form, command, which might even be considered a participle here with this name here. And then we'll be getting to that later when we look at the paradigm for these. And then we have the idea of tzvah, to command. In other words, to make a command. And then zimra, music or song. We've got zimmer, to sing, to make music. So the object of music is being verbalized here. We've got, here's an interesting one, shalosh, meaning three, and you get shalesh, to divide something into three parts or to do something for a third time. Might be an appropriate verb to describe the Council of Nicaea, I don't know. But to divide something into three parts, or to do something for a third time. In context, we have to decide that. And then kin'ah, jealousy, and we've got kin'ay, to be jealous. To be jealous. And that's a stated type of verb, to be jealous, but it's a PL because of a denominative function. You normally wouldn't associate a stated verb with PL, but in this denominative sense where you're taking the idea of jealousy and then making it a verbal idea, that can happen. Okay. So there's another sense, denominative function. And usually in the denominative function, you won't see any call form for the verb. It'll only be in the PL. There's a lot of verbs that are that way. You only find in the PL. Then his third category is the intensive. And he doesn't really say much about this. Makes it rather nebulous, and I'm not even sure of any. He doesn't give any examples. But he says, in several instances, the PL denotes a pluralization of the action named in the call. Now, how you pluralize an action, what sense he's getting at, I'm not sure. It may involve, you know, spreading the action out or magnifying the idea of the action and so forth rather than number, because action, you can't really talk about actions in terms of numbers usually. And he doesn't give an example, so it's hard to ascertain exactly what he's referring to here. And I can't think of examples. It'd be a real hard thing to find some unless they're given. So it might be worth checking Jesenius or something else to see if they've got any more information on this. It says, this may take on the nuance of an intensive, but the intensive force is difficult to discern in most occurrences. Many of the so-called intensive PLs seem to be more stylistic variants of the call verb, most likely denominative in origin, used in poetry, probably for variation rather than intensification. And again, I think that's reflecting a bit of a bias on his part. I I think that you really do see intensive ideas. The verb to kill, making it in PL, oftentimes will give the idea of slaughtering or, you know, killing on a large scale. And that may be an example of what he's talking about here. Is that could be kind of a pluralization, to kill and then to slaughter, to massacre. He would be killing lots of people all at once. And that could be a pluralization. And that's certainly an intensive idea. Yeah, I don't think he likes the intensive idea because maybe he's trying to define it too rigidly. Most of the books don't define it that rigidly. They're just talking about it's intensified in some sense. And whether it's pluralization or whether it's making a transitive verb out of a stative verb or whatever, there's certainly this idea there, and I have no difficulty seeing that. Okay, then he gives a kind of an all-inclusive fourth category, the unclassified. Anything else that's PL, you can't figure out why that goes in this category. And so in addition to the three preceding categories, there are many PL verbs whose origin is not clear. Some of these verbs could doubtlessly be placed in the above classifications if we have more data on the related call or nominal forms. In other words, we might find a PL verb form that doesn't, there's no call form in existence, and there's no noun that relates to it. And so what do we do with it? You know, we just have to kind of use it the way it's found. But he's saying that if we had more information, there may have originally been a noun or it may have been a call form that dropped out or something like that, and we might be able to categorize it as one of these others. Now, here's a few examples. Pizdar, to scatter. There's no call form, there's no verb, noun associated with it and so forth, so it's really hard to trace it. We've got geirish, to drive away. Bikesh, to seek. Michar, to hurry or hasten. Now, awareness of the factative denominative intensive function of a PL, together with the familiarity of a given root, will certainly assist the learner in mastering these new verbs. But because he will not be able to predict unerringly the meaning of a new PL verb, they will be listed in the vocabularies of the following lessons. And you really need that, because you may know a call verb and then see a PL form of it, and you may make a pretty good guess as to what it means on the basis of that, but you may be wrong. You know, in other words, it's not so precise a science that you can just say, oh, the PL is obviously going to mean this. The PL may be a denominative type of an idea, or it may be a factative idea, or it may be an intensive idea. And you wouldn't necessarily know just by guessing. You know it's a PL, you know it's one of those possibilities, but you wouldn't be able to necessarily guess which one it was. And therefore, for that reason, he's going to list the PL verbs in the vocabularies and give you the meanings for them, so that'll be decided for you. And you usually have to resort to that anyway. Once you see a PL form and know what it means, then you can see the relationship to the other, and you get some insight there. But there's just too many options to be able to predict it without error. You might be able to give a ballpark, you know. You might be able to say, well, it's probably either this, this, or this. You know, I've seen that happen. When I run across a new PL verb, sometimes I've thought, well, it could mean one of these things. And then you look it up and you find out you were right on one of them anyway, you know. But you still wouldn't be able to dogmatically conclude which one it was. Yes? Who originally decided? Well, I suppose just the ones who spoke the language. In other words, it's just the way that they used it in their language. Now, you do have there is another potential question, though, and that has to do with the Masoretes and the way they've appointed these things, because in many instances the only difference in some of the forms is one of vowel points. However, this doubling of the middle radical in most of these is going to show up even without the Masoretes, because apparently what they did before, they used the dagesh, they just wrote the letter twice. And so having the letter written down both times would be quite a, you know, would be a distinctive feature that would make a difference in the forms. But there are some forms that are guttural in the second position, can't take the dagesh, and there might be some reasons for some raising some questions about them too.
So these meanings, do they go back to people studying how people translate it?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, Septuagint would give some information on that, right? And other Hebrew writings, cognate languages of other sorts as well. That's the kind of information that the linguists have to go by in trying to especially decide between these forms. Then also the very context. For example, if you have one where you've got a stative verb and then a PL form with that transitivizes it, you can usually identify those grammatically because the transitive form is going to have a direct object and the other one will never have a direct object and that kind of thing. There may be some grammatical things that will help you too. Then as far as this denominative, you get relationships between, you know, you can pretty well identify nouns in their grammatical syntax, and then seeing a verb built from the noun, that's pretty easy to see too. So I think that it's more, you know, what's really happened to come up with these categories is what they've done is looked at all the PL verbs in form and then seen how they related to calls or other things and then came up with these categories after the fact. But the idea of the PL is pretty clearly seen in the language, and there are enough differences in the forms where as far as the paradigm is concerned, there's no question that the paradigm of the PL is different than the paradigm of the call, and we can see the relationship between those forms. So we know that there's formal distinctions. We know also how these different words are used within context, and from that we can derive some of these distinctions. That's basically where we have to go. Although there are some that, of course, are hard to fit in, like this unclassified category.
The thing that's in my mind is it's been classified, you know, many times where there's several possible meanings or something. The Holy Spirit intentionally used things like that in order to say various meanings, and it's blending on something like this for an eyes by taking another meaning that might really fit something really well, and your revelation body.
Sure.
And, but none of the lexicons
support it.
Go that way.
Well, let me put it this way. I think that if you see a PL form and say it's only used a few times in the scripture, and the commentators all go one direction on it because of certain theological bias, for example, and there's another possibility for the PL there. As in, say they give it a transitive idea and it should be, and you think it should be intensive, then I would say you've got some ground to raise questions with their interpretation if you can see there's evidence and it fits better this way and it ties into other things better and so forth. On the other hand, if you find a verb that's used a lot of times and you can look by inspection and see its consistent use all the way in other places independent of the passage in question, then you probably have some pretty good solid basis for concluding this is what it means, just because that's the way it seems to always be used. On the other hand, there may be a verb that is used maybe a couple different ways, and you can find good solid support for its use in both different ways. Then you might have justification, of course, in this questionable passage to take it the way that you feel fits into the rest of the scripture, if there's a couple of options. I don't know if that's really the case with PLs, if there are some that could be taken either as intensive, say, or denominative, but that those are kinds of options I think we do need to consider. Because remember, these grammatical distinctions are just observations made by grammarians, and that's something we need to always remember, that there isn't a tag that comes with the Hebrew language from birth, you know, that says these are the various categories. You know, it's the way people talked, and it's the way they used words, and it's the way things. And then we're making observations about what was written and how it was written and categorizing those uses. And that always, anytime you start getting to these subcategories, when you're dealing with strict form, formal distinctions, you've got pretty good, you know, solid basis for category distinctions. But then when you go into these subcategories, then that's where there tends to be a lot more divergence among the scholars, and there also tends to be the possibility of of maybe refining things too much, or if you've set up certain categories and the forms are the same for all those categories, and the scholar says it's one of these, it's in this category, and the other guy says no, it's in this category, that's going to happen. That happens all the time in Greek too. You know, for example, we'll get into this, and the Greek students will get into this year, but there's, say, objective genitives, subjective genitives, genitive of kind, and so there's a whole list of different types of genitives. Well, all you've got in the Greek is a genitive form. And so the conclusion about whether it's objective, subjective, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is based upon context and the judgment of the scholar. So we need to recognize that one scholar may say subjective, the other guy might say objective. And we need to know, when we see statements like that, what they're worth. In other words, what they're based on. And so that's what one of the things I'm going to emphasize as we go through things like that, is to say, now these categories, take with a grain of salt. Recognize that these various kinds exist. Usually when they delineate the categories, they're right in that all those kinds of uses are seen. But then making a specific judgment in a specific passage as to which category it is, that's something else. That's where you're having to make a judgment yourself about that. The form doesn't tell you. It's context and other things. And how a person perceives the context and other things, of course, can dictate what he's going to conclude on that one particular passage. Okay. Well, looking at the forms now. Section 149. First, we've got the three categories here. Regular, three guttural, and two guttural. Take the simple ones first. The regular ones are pretty straightforward. It's a different vocalic pattern. The perfect is for a verb that, say, the call would be gadal. The perfect for there may not be a call for this one, but the imperfect now. I mean, excuse me. The perfect of the pl would be gidale, gidale, with a double dalef there in the second radical and the hirik tseri pattern. That's your common pattern for a strong verb. The imperfect is yigadale. You got Dale, and it's a shawa in the first syllable, not a hirik like the call has. And then you have its pattern is shawa pathak seri. You got Dale, and you have also the doubling as well of the dalit that is seen in the imperfect as well. Imperative got Dale, you just drop the y off, and that's kind of analogous to what you saw before for the call. Infinitive construct got Dale, same form. And participle, megadale. We've got a prefix mame here for your PL participles. We'll see this again, but this is another thing to keep watching for. Mames do get prefixed to verb forms, and now we're seeing it.
That's why ragale for spy.
Sure.
Is actually a PL participle of ragale. Mm-hmm. To look for, to watch
sure.
For spy.
Exactly. So very often nouns will be built from this, but they're PL participles, for example, or maybe hifil participles. We'll get to those later, too. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. You just transpose two letters there. Okay. Then remarks. Excuse me, I don't want to go too far here. We're going to look at the two gutturals. The two guttural, or three guttural. The three guttural, you have a guttural in the last position, and that's going to tend to get a pafak instead of a tseri. They don't like to end with tseris and then a guttural. So we've got shilach, shilach, and yishalach. And for the imperfect, again, just the only difference really is that vowel point, tseri to pafak. And then the imperative, shalach, the infinitive construct, shalach, and the participle, mishalayach, mishalayach. There you get your tseri pack back in the participle, but then a pathach furtive on the end. Then two gutturals, there's two categories of these. They can do one of two things. You see, with a guttural in the second position, what's your problem going to be with PL?
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubling possible. Can't take the dagesh. So, and what from your past experience are the kinds of things that are likely to happen in situations like that? Eric?
Lengthening.
Yeah, compensatory lengthening, and what was another one? Virtual doubling, where nothing happens, basically. Okay. And that's the two categories here. This first verb, be'er, is getting k compensates a virtual doubling. In other words, nothing's really happened except you just don't have a digation in the guttural. But the pattern's the same otherwise. It's hiric seri. And then the one underneath that, may-in, there's an example where you've got compensatory lengthening. The hiric lengthened to seri in the first, under the first radical to compensate for the lack of the digation in the aleph. So there's two. There's a divergence there. In the imperfect, we've got yiva'er and yima'in. Again, the difference there is the imperfect for the yiva'er is just the same patterns we saw above, but no dagesh, of course, in the ayin. But below that, we get the comets instead of the pasach under the first radical of the stem. And so it's yima'in with the comets under the name instead of the pasach. Imperative, ba'er, ma'ein, again the same distinction. The infinitive construct, ba'er, ma'ein, same thing there. And the participle, m'ba'er and m'ma'ein, again the same thing with the comets in the second one and the pasach in the first. So that's your basic observations. Here's his comments, kind of remarks, kind of summarize that. Number one, there are essentially only two stems, the perfect and the imperfect. As elsewhere, the imperative and infinitive construct are predictable from the imperfect. The participle also resembles the imperfect, but with the prefix mem, shwa there. So the participle is basically like the imperfect. You just put the mem shwa in there instead of the yod shwa. Okay, then secondly, PL verbs from the root three guttural deviate only in having pathak as the second stem vowel throughout, except in the participle. So the participle is the only odd vowel there. Otherwise, it's just pathak instead of seri everywhere. In the participle, you're going to get the seri back, and probably if it's a chayth or a ayin, it's going to get the pathak furtive there. Then thirdly, even in non-guttural verbs, the stem vowel pathak instead of seri is found in the perfect. So we have gedel or gedal. The choice would appear to be optional. There are a few verbs, notably diber, to speak, and kipper, yom kipper, to atone for, which have segol instead of seri or pathak in the third masculine singular of the perfect. So there are a few verbs that go have a segol there. PL, and then fourth comment, PL verbs from roots two guttural, including resh. Resh would be in the same condition. Resh would be in the same category as gutturals for this consideration, because remember, resh can't take dagesh, and that's your problem with the guttural in this case. So resh can take shwa, unlike gutturals, but with regard to doubling, resh falls in the same category. These verbs fall into two classes, as I mentioned. Class A, those with virtual doubling of the guttural in question. So be'er, for example, where really nothing happens, the vocalization is the same as that of the regular verb. B, those with compensatory lengthening of the vowel before the guttural. The hiric goes to seri, pathak goes to comets. And so me'ein above is an example of that. Before resh, compensatory lengthening is the rule. So generally you're going to see if resh is the second radical in the verb, then you're going to see generally a compensatory lengthening taking place. The other gutturals may be treated in either way, as will be indicated in the vocabularies. So you just have to learn it with the verb as you go on the rest of them. Okay, the full paradigm now, we've only kind of looked at the dictionary forms of each of these, or the third person masculine singulars. For the full paradigm, for the perfect here, for gideo, for example, it's gideo, gidala, so you get that seri reducing to schwa. Gedalta, gedalt. Now the seri has gone to pasach in these forms. So it's not gedalta, but gedalta, gedalt, gedalti, gidalu, gidaltem, gidalten, gidalnu. So it's pasach throughout the rest of the paradigm. The seri only appears in the third person masculine singular form. The rest of the places it's either a shwa or a pasach in that position. So that's something to remember too. In other words, don't rely upon the seri to identify your PL forms. Rely more upon the hiric and if it's perfect, rely more upon the hiric in the first syllable and the doubling of the second radical. Those are the things to really watch for, because you know the third person masculine singular form may be the most common form you'll see, but if you see it in any of these other forms, you won't see it seri there. Okay, and then shalach and its full paradigm. We've got shalacha, shalachta, shalacht, Shalachti, Shalachu, Shalachu, Shalachtem, Shalachten, Shalachnu. See, it's pretty much the same as you've seen before. Once you get this basic pattern change in the vowels in the front, the suffixes are all the same, and the patterns and so forth are just the same. So you just make a few adjustments, and then you've got the pattern that you learned before. Okay, and Be'er, there, because it's a guttural, it can't take Shua in that second position. So Be'ara there, and Be'arta, Be'art, etc., Be'arti, Be'aru, Be'artem, Be'arten, etc. Yes, John.
I was going to say that, again, our indicators are, aware of our indicators are all those addressing the master instrument.
Yes, they are, except for the possibility of the, you know, like I mentioned, if the second radical is not a guttural, then the doubling that's seen by the Masoretes is probably a reflection of actual two letters written in the original form. In other words, they just reduce that to putting just a dot in one of them.
That was standard.
Yeah, so that would have been, you know, identifiable even before the Masoretes.
Dagesh 14.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the original forms actually wrote out two letters in a row, and they just streamlined it down to putting a Dagesh 14 in. Yeah, that. Yeah, otherwise a lot of these forms you're totally left up in the air, because the only difference is now with Hifils, we'll see that there's a Hirik Yod that comes in there, and a Yod would be seen Hifil, and in the Hay prefix, Hifils would be really easy to identify independent of Masoretic vowel points. Same with Hithpael. But the PL, the Pual, the Nifal, well, the Nifal, you got the Nun, so that usually helps you there. But some, in some cases, that gets assimilated, so you'd have some trouble in some of those, potentially. Okay, the imperfect forms, I think I'll just go through the strong imperfect one here, this first one. Yigadel, Tigadel, Tigadel, Tigadali, Agadel. Of course, the ayin can't take shwa, so that's going to get a chatef pasak on it. So agadel, yigadalu, tigadelna, tigadalu, tigadelna, and nigadel. So those you could, again, it's the same kind of pattern you've seen before. You just get that, if you learn that first one and you set the pattern, you can pretty well predict all the rest of the forms. And of course, if you remember that the guttural tent can't take shwa, you could get that agadel there too. It's pretty, you know, logical once you know the rules you already know. Imperatives, gadel, gadali, gadalu, gadelna. Same kind of philosophy as before. Lop off the prefix of the appropriate imperfect forms and you have it. Infinitive construct. Same thing with suffixes now. Gadel. Gadali, Gadalaka, or excuse me, Gadelka, Gadalake, etc. They're just putting those suffixes on. Definitive absolute, we've got Gadol, therefore it's a Pathak form, and then the Dalit has still got the Dagesh, and then you get the Kol and Wow. So it's not unlike the forms we've seen before. The participle, maybe the most interesting, Megadel, and then of course that name carries through the various forms of the participle. We have four forms, masculine, feminine, singular, and plurals. And so, Megadala, so forth for the feminine form, Megadalim, and Megadaloth. Okay, and then appropriately for the other forms here. A few more remarks. Number one, after a vowel conversive, the prefix y of the imperfect loses its vowel, and the yod is not doubled. So here's another peculiarity, and this is going to make them even more difficult to see, to recognize. Well, maybe not too bad, you know, as far as the rest of the form is concerned, but it is kind of peculiar. You see, your normal way of identifying a vowel consecutive is that doubling of the first radical in addition to the pathak form. So what you're going to see with these is that it's going to be, for example, yma'ain rather than yma'ain that you might have expected. It's yma'ain. And they don't get the... I suppose that, you know, the reasoning is that you're going to shorten it by one syllable. If you don't put the dagesh in the yod, then the schwa under there is going to get silent. It'll be closing the first syllable with a short vowel. And so why my ain, it just shortens it up. So I guess that's the real reasoning behind it. So the only formal problem here is that there's no dagesh in the oath. And that's going to tell you that you pronounce it Waimain. Okay, then secondly, the characteristic doubling of the middle radical is given up sometimes when it is followed by the vowel shawa. That's all you need. Because that was one of the things you looked at to try to identify these forms. But sometimes they'll give it up if shawa is the following. And again, just to shorten the syllables. So you get bikesh here, he sought, but bikshu, they sought. So sometimes they'll drop the dagesh out of that so that the shawa goes silent and you shorten it up. And yibakesh for the imperfect he will seek, but yibakshu, they will seek. This loss of doubling never occurs with the consonants begad kafat, otherwise no clear rule can be formulated. So they never do it with begad kafats, but once in a while they'll do it without any clear rule formulated. And so you have to just watch this. Unfortunately, this is what will happen. And so we need to keep our eyes open when we're reading the text. And just because it doesn't have the dagesh in the second radical does not necessarily mean it's not PL. Sometimes they'll give that up before a shawa. Okay, then thirdly, the forms listed above and in the next lesson for the infinitive absolute are rather rare. More frequently, the PL infinitive construct is used as the infinitive absolute. So they've given an infinitive absolute, gadol, over here, but he's saying that that's relatively rare. Usually in places where they would have an infinitive absolute, they'll use an infinitive construct form. They just use gadol. And then maybe, for example, you might see gadol, gidal, or something like that, or gadol, gidal, or something. Making great, he made great, or something, you know. It's they would use just the infinitive absolute form. I mean, infinitive construct form instead of an infinitive absolute more often than not. Okay. Well, that brings us to the vocab and the exercises. Let me just tell you for tomorrow what the exercises will be. And again, we're shortening this up a bit. Only in part A are you have anything as far as the translation here. Numbers 1, 8, and 16. 1, 8, and 16 under part A. And then nothing in part B or C, but the reading in part D. And there we're actually got the verses numbered and so forth, and it's right from Genesis 44, 18 to 26, vocalization slightly altered. That has to do with meter and rhyme, and he hasn't really covered pause and things like that, so there's going to be some changes there. But other than that, I think it's right from the text. And he's giving footnotes in places where you needed where he had a pronominal suffix onto the verb and so forth. So it's pretty much right from the text, except for slight, just more of poetic things and, you know, things that happen because of meter and rhyme. So we're pretty much into the text now. Okay, so just part A, 1, 8, and 16, and then this reading in part D. We'll do that for tomorrow.
This is chapter 40.
Yes, yeah, you know what's coming. Yeah, that means vocab quiz coming up and then grammar quiz, which is primarily translation. Although some of these chapters, it's more appropriate to give some grammar questions. Since we're dealing with PL and NIFAL, I may be asking you a few questions also about, not about detailed forms. I'll tell you more detail about it before I give it to you. But in other words, I'm going to be able to incorporate a few grammar questions, and then the translation will all be right from the, you know, these last portions as before. So let's see, what would be a good time to figure up here? We'll take us tomorrow to go through these exercises. Probably next Tuesday would be a good time. Have we been having Tuesdays and Thursdays where they're good test days? Okay, we can make, but this one we might split up into 2 weeks. We could say next Tuesday for the vocab and the Tuesday following for the, because we don't have a break coming up or anything, the Tuesday following for the grammar. Is that satisfactory with everybody? And what dates would those be then? 6th and 13th. Okay, that would be lessons 37 to 40, vocab, November 6th, and 37 to 40, grammar, November 13th. Okay?
On that grammar, the translation,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to do a spot only for those that we already have translated, or for all of the translations.
Just the parts we have translated. In other words, the parts I've gone through with you in class. Yeah.
Okay.
But there will be some grammar questions on this one too. So I'll probably write them on the board or something, and then you'll write those down as well. Okay, I guess that's only the first bell, so we can go through the vocab list here. And of course, most of this is verbs. There's just only one thing that's not a verb in this vocab list, although he gets a little idiom down here too. So we've got kadesh, to sanctify. That's the PL form. Ba'ar would be your call form to burn, could be either transitive or intransitive. And then be'er would be to burn transitively, or consume or remove completely. Sometimes it's translated as well. Diber, to be, to speak, to talk. Be'reish, to bless, or be'reich, excuse me, to bless. Be'kesh, to seek. Shalach, to expel or send forth. Now remember, we had a verb, the call form of this already, shalach, which meant what? To send, okay. And this means to expel. You can see you're sending with more force here, you see. And that's the intensive. This is a very good, to me, a very good example of the pure intensive idea. To send, but then to expel it, to send it out with speed, you know, with force. Send forth. Okay, gay resh, to drive away. And that one's a denominative, there isn't any. Or no, that was one of the ones that we put in the unclassified category. It didn't even have a noun. And then we've got ni'eitz, to spurn. There's a two guttural. And that's one that doesn't get the, that's a virtual doubling one. And then me'ain, there's one that gets compensatory lengthening, to refuse. And then we've got she'reith, to serve or administer. Okay. Then the other, here we have just plain O, meaning or. It's a conjunction. So if you want to say or, this or that, it's just O in the Hebrew. Then note the idiom, k and k, to, you know, the preposition k on two things. It's kind of like this, like that, if you translated it literally. But the translation may vary with the context, but the implication is that the two items involved are in some way equal. And you can almost see that, although we wouldn't want to translate it this, but you know, we say things like father, like son. And what we're trying to say is that they're equivalent somehow. There's a certain sense in which they're equivalent. And that's the thing I think of, just to try to get some kind of correlation to English with what's happening here. But here, we may not want to translate it that way always, of course, but kamoka kefaro, you are the equal of Pharaoh. In other words, like you, like Pharaoh, you know, literally. And remember, kamoka is just the preposition k with its pronominal suffixes, and it gets the main there, so remember that complicated paradigm. Or kamoka kamoni, you and I are equal, or you and I are in the same predicament, you know, like you, like me, you know, here we are, you know, we're in the same boat, as it were, okay? All right. We're just about out of time here. I suppose we could. Well, you haven't really had a chance to prepare on these, so I don't know if I'll spring this on you. I'd rather wait till tomorrow, and we'll look at these. Yes, Tony?
I ask you one question. Even though we in English have to put our own superimposed divisions on things, do the Hebrews have their own set of grammatical statements that they describe their phrases by? When they teach them to their kids, how do they get across whether it's a, they don't know the PL, maybe, or maybe
they call it. Oh, yeah, I think they would probably, in their grammar books, not be opposed to using terms like PL, PUAL, and so forth. Those are, those terms actually come from Hebrew grammar books. You know, that's the way they categorized them. So they're fully cognizant of these various derived verbs and so forth. The question about subcategorizing those, the PL, for example, into facultative and this and that and so forth, that I'm not so sure about. I'm not so sure that they will go to that extent of breaking it down so much with themselves, just because they may just lump them all together and say PL can be a lot of these different things.
I'm just wondering if the terminology that the Hebrews would use would in any way give them a clearer description of the function of different words.
Well, there's going to be one gigantic problem you're going to have, and that is as far as I know, we don't have any grammar books of ancient Hebrew. In other words, we don't have anything. The only thing we could go by would be rabbis and traditions and things like that, or modern Hebrew, just to see what they're doing in modern Hebrew. But modern Hebrew wouldn't be indicative of biblical Hebrew. In other words, if you went and looked at what the modern Hebrew grammar books do in Israel when they're teaching people that came from Europe or something like that how to speak Hebrew, that would be good for what they're doing now, but that wouldn't necessarily reflect the way grammar was taught. And remember, too, that most people in a country that are learning a language don't learn it from the standpoint of grammatical paradigms. They learn it only from the standpoint of that's the way they talk. They learn it as a complex system of habits. And so whether they had formal language classes, you know, say in Jesus' day, teaching them Hebrew grammar and so forth is kind of questionable, you know, the way they, if they even structured it the way that we do.
Well, we know they didn't. We know that at least the Greeks didn't.
Oh yeah, they memorizing paradigms. It's likely, but we, you know, like I say, unless we have the data to support it, it gets more difficult to know how they did it. You know. Yeah, maybe. Okay, that's all for today. We will go through the exercises tomorrow and then have quizzes next week. Following lesson 41, we'll continue PL with the, you know, the rest of the oddball forms. And we get to Pu'al in lesson 42, so only one more lesson on PL.
I've been doing some of the other exercises, the ones that weren't for practice.
Yes.
And I've been having some problems.
Okay.
During the class sometime, not class, but free time, could I?
Yeah, check with me on
them. Right.
Sure. Good. Yeah, I won't have the answers written on those, but they'll be able to help you with them anyway. Glad to. Derived verbs for
I don't know what I'm doing.
Right.